Bonnie knows when you plant something, it keeps on giving. Growing from friend to neighbor to community. Generations of gardeners have trusted Bonnie for fresh, healthy vegetable and herb plants. Rely on Bonnie for quality plants, help, and support. Bonnie, gardening with you since 1918. BonniePlants.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, and I am here this morning with a friend of mine, someone whose work I greatly, greatly respect, the very first producer in Barolo that I ever visited, the first lady of Barolo, I say, Miss Chiara Boschis from Ipira Winery. Ipira, we have your wines on, Chiara, we have your wines on all of our lists. I love your work so much. I think you're just a tremendous person, a great, great producer. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for inviting me. Sorry, my English is not perfect, but I hope I don't make too many mistakes and messes. But thank you very much. For me, it's a great honor and a great pleasure to be here with you. Of course, I love you because you're such a nice guy, so talented, and so it was a great opportunity for me to come here and talk to you and your listener.
Yes. Okay. You can go off script now that you said that I was great. You don't have to read the script anymore. I'm just kidding. It's okay. Well, Chiara, welcome to the show. I do want to note that it is Women's History Month in America right now.
Yeah.
And you, in many ways, are a pioneer in winemaking in Piemonte, in the my favorite winemaking region in the world, in Barolo. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the struggles that you might have had, or were you very embraced early on? What was it like being a woman at that time in Piemonte?
Oh, yeah. Yes, you're right. This, the 8 Marzo is a Festa della Donna that we feel more in Europe probably than here. It's not so well known, but yes, it's celebrating, the concept is to celebrate the woman liberation and so. But I have to say to you that my generation was already the generation that took advantage of all those work and that has been done by our mothers and our grandmothers who really struggled to get the same right, the same opportunities, and gave us the freedom to choose what to do in our life. So I had already this opportunity. You know, my mother, like my parents, had their life ruined by the war, the Second World War, so their youth was gone in a very sad period, and what they really wanted for their kids was a better life and a better opportunity. So they gave me the possibility to study, which is a kind of holiday in the good way. I mean, I studied very much, of course, because I liked it, but then they gave me the possibility to choose freely what to do. And this is a great, great gift that life can give it to you. So they did all the sacrifice and work so much to give me and my brothers this opportunity. So I was already a favorite in a way. Even if I had, and you know, before, for sure, this condition that, the situation, I would say, of the women were quite pre-descripted because the women normally get married, they have children, and they were going away following the husbands that were very often take them away from their original environment, especially away from the countryside. Because, you know, I come from the part of Italy, this part of Italy, but all Italy was very rural, and there was a moment, especially especially after the Second World War, in which the people tend to abandon it, the countryside, because the life was so hard that you couldn't really make a living. And especially the women were happy to marry someone that took them away from the hard life of the countryside. So I was already, I was lucky because, you know, I studied and I had many more opportunity, and especially this freedom to choose what I want. And it's funny, when you leave the door of the cage open, the birds never fly away. And so I stayed, decided, of course, that I love the work that my parents were doing. I saw so much sacrifice they were doing, so much they were doing this work with so much love, mm-hmm. that me and my brothers, of course, were in love. And it's true that I was one of the first women winemakers, but today you should see every winery is the daughters and are involved, and they are very brilliant, they are nice. So it's very common today, but yeah, my time not so much. But I have to say that I've been accepted by the group, especially my group, the original group of the Barolo boys, you know, and I was the Barolo girls for them. And I've been accepted with a great friendship, and I've been growing with this group of friend waymaker.
Now, well. When you decided to go to school and you said you didn't study enology right away, did you?
No, actually, not really, because again, the family, there was a kind of division of the work. And the girls, theoretically, were not supposed to make the more physical work, like, you know, winemaking or even the agriculture. Well, the agriculture, yes, in the sense that women has a very good hand work, you know. So, and you know that the agriculture for us is so important. We are farmers, essentially, first of all. And the work that you do on the plant is, I always said that more than viticulture is gardening, because it's kind of a work of delicate finesse, you know, and the women's are very good at that, but not the other, I mean the big work, like to be a consultant or to study, you know, to a higher level. So and of course my family, because I come from a nine generation winery family, that the house was established in 1761. So my mother was encouraging me to do economics, study languages. You know, the girls are very good at that also today. And in fact, if you see in the wine world, they are normally the girls are the beautiful face of the wineries. So they were asking me to do these things, but I never really liked to deal with numbers or whatever. So
when you finished school, you said, I'm coming right back to the winery.
Yes. Yeah. I did that. I did a little experience outside the house, mm-hmm. Outside the winery, which is good. I work actually for an American company, and was good to make a little bit of experience then, because otherwise when you came home, they always treat you like a young person, you know, and it's different here in America. People is really thrown into the work very young, like you, for example. And in Italy, the youngs are always kept a little bit on the back, and which is a pity many times. And so I had to, you know, to do also at home a little bit of work, kind of more in the office at the beginning, but then I had much more passion for the work of the cellar and the winery and the vineyard. And so when there was the occasion, the opportunity to this small jewel winery came on sale, because the owner unfortunately died, and they were a good friend of my family. You know, I pushed my father like crazy. I start to say, look, dad, you know, I'm not in this winery. It's not correct. I want to be treated exactly like my brothers. I
want to have an
opportunity.
And just to clarify, the family winery is the Borgogna winery.
Yeah?
And then the one that came up was Luigi Pira.
Pira. Enrico Pira. Yeah, it's called I Pira and Figli. And so I add my name, Chiara Boschi, because now, of course, there are many winery with It's quite confusing, I guess, in Piemonte, because everybody has the same name in many occasions. And so now everybody knows me like Pira Chiaraboschis, because there are, of course, many very good wineries with the same name.
And and the first vintage was 1990, is that correct?
Yeah, the winery was purchased in 1980, but at that time I was still a little bit young, and I really took the occasion to, and kind of also break a little bit with my father. There was a moment of tension, I can say, because there was a moment in the 90s, especially in the 90s, where me and other friends, we were trying new road, new ways. So we were experimenting, and it was kind of very vibrant and lively moment, but also with some incomprehension and some fight in a way, you know.
Yes, because this was a huge divergence from the way that things were done in the past. Barolo in Italy, it's such a historic, maybe the most historic region, the longest tradition of high quality winemaking.
Exactly.
And I'm sure that the people who had the idea of doing things in a particular way said, we have good reason to do it this way because it's been done for such a long time.
Yes.
And see, we've established a great name for ourselves. But something was going on at that time with you and your friends that were, you guys were looking more towards the future as opposed to the past.
Yeah.
And tell us about that, about what were those conversations like when you were first like, maybe we should do things a little bit differently.
Exactly. You're right. You know, we were used to hear our father saying, okay, our grandfather, my father said do this, my grandfather do this, my grandfather do this, so we have to do this. But of course, the youngs are always a little bit revolutionary. This is in the nature, you know, so we wanted to explore and experiment. And because we were a group, I would say that I grew up with some of the best winemaker that are actually a rock star and great, smart people, really. People that, were so passionate that I remember we were only talking about how to improve the quality, how to make better. We really wanted to make the wine better of the world. We wanted to be appreciated, everywhere. And so we started to discuss, to try together. The occasion, of course, were to meet together, have good, great dinners and great drinks, to tell you the truth. But was always with a good meaning, because we were exchanging ideas, and then we start to experiment. So we were starting to experiment those things that are not written on the books. So we were trying different temperature fermentation, different oak, different this, different that. So, and all the new ideas were immediately embraced and experimented right away. So, of course, this group was a little bit seen like, revolutionary at the beginning, and also people was kind of suspicious, of course, but I think we introduced something that today everybody, even the more traditional winemaker, introduce absolutely in their way of vinifying and handling also the vineyard, because we started to we understood, of course, that our great richness is the terroir, so which doesn't mean all the soil, but the exposition and the differences in the soil, the difference in the microclimate, and also this importance of the indigenous variety that we have. So we realized that we had to play this. So we couldn't simply, go like plant a Cabernet or whatever to become famous. No, we didn't want to do that. We wanted to really concentrate on our variety and try to improve the quality. So we work very much, even more in the vineyard, decreasing the crop, getting more expression and concentration in the grapes. Some people went even too far. There were kind of the fathers were worried that we bankrupt completely, because we were throwing away almost all the product, all the grape, to have very little, la creme de la creme. And so,
was that mostly from green harvesting or
harvesting
or pruning to
everything?
Okay,
yeah,
to everything. Really reduce the yield.
Yeah. and then also the use of clean and so new mm-hmm. barrels was necessary. The tradition was to keep those 100 years old barrels, but some were good, but sometimes some were not good. So we had to change and go in the direction of having new wood, but also new cellar. We restored, we bought, we were spending, investing a lot of money to get the best equipment, clean everything, you know, even restoring the cellars. And the third thing that we have been working with was the concept really to underline the terroir. So we started to vinify the single cru, while, for example, in the tradition way, the wines were always blended, mm-hmm. coming from different plots. No wine, the plot were blended. We only have, 100% the same kind of wine, the same kind of grape. But it was kind of the blend in order to make wines that were more homogeneous. So, and we started on the contrary to push on that side, on the diversity of the different terroir. And so today I think that the two ideas cohabitate, but for sure many things that, that we introduce have been recognized as smart. Then, of course, we made a mistake as well. So we went on, we come back. It's normal, you know.
Yeah, I mean, these three ideas of fully ripe grapes, cleanliness in the cellar, and showcasing specific single vineyard sites doesn't seem like it's that radical. But I guess at the time in Barolo, it was quite a departure from what most people were doing. We're actually going to take just a quick break. We'll be back with more on In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I am here with Chiara Boschis of E. Pira & Fili Winery. And before we left, we were talking about sort of the three major changes and improvements that happened during the years of the 80s and the 90s when Chiara and her friends started making wine. But I wanted to dive down into a little bit more about the generational shift and the change that happened from your parents' generation and the way they made wine and the way that they approached the business, and when you started making wine and we're doing things like investing in new barrels and a new cellar, and how did that go over?
Well, as I was telling you before, after the Second World War, the country has to be reconstructed. So the generation of my parents, for example, they never really had any money. You know, actually, a lot of people was almost starving. And that's why, for example, there was also a lot of immigration, you know. So there was not really a future so clear at the beginning. But and so I think that the generation of my parents has only been working, and that's it all their life. And they were kind of also scared to spend money, you know. I think that my generation started what was a little bit more the consumistic era, probably. But I'm still in the middle because I still was used. My family taught me to spare very much, and so don't spend the money if it was not super necessary. And of course, at that time, I realized that investment was super necessary. But at the eyes of the other, we look like crazy. We're spending this so much money investing in the cellar, buy new barrels, buy new equipment. It was a lot of money. My father was scared. He said, "You will take me to bankrupt," you know. And and that's why also all these winemakers were looking at us. We look like the generation with the hand with the hole, you know, and kind of they were looking at us like if we were so.
Why buy a new barrel if you can use it for 100 years?
Exactly. But the problem was that some of those very, very old barrels really need to be replaced. Mm-hmm. And I think that today the quality of the wine in my area is grown up so much because everybody realized how important it was to go for clean and more new equipment to increase the quality.
And during our break, you were telling me that you remember growing up there was quite a bit of Barolo that was stinky, that was off in some kind of way. And now, regardless of the producer, it's pretty hard to find a stinky Barolo.
Well, stinky. I mean, as I told you, maybe some barrels were not so good. So you could find some more rustic, I would
more
say.
Rustic. More okay.
rustic. More
stinky
rustic.
Stinky is my word.
Yeah.
Not yours.
No, a little bit more rustic. So what we tried to do was to work more on giving more fruit to the wine. So, so all the way that we handle the fruit with a lot of care, also the temperature control during the fermentation, all those concepts were in order to preserve the fruity side of the wine, you know. So because you can do the wine, you don't really need, of course, all these sophisticated equipment, expensive vat, temperature control, or things like that. You can do it in a normal way. But of course, the problem is that when you have, some extreme situation like temperature going up or temperature going down, you may have some problem during the vinification. So of course, certain things helps you to keep everything always under control and to essentially to preserve the fruit that is very important for wine, like Barolo, for example, that has a lot of tannin and a lot of acidity. So you need to have fruit in front to kind of make a camouflage of those hard body that is behind, you know?
Yeah, to balance it all out.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. It's balanced.
Exactly. So you said that in those years in the 80s and 90s, you were doing a lot of experiments. Were there any that went drastically wrong? Did you try something and it was a terrible idea and you think about it now, you're like, how could I ever think of that? Like a sparkling sweet Nebbiolo or something like that?
Well, no, not really like that. But what we were trying was really experimenting with, of course, a small plot. I mean, in order to see the differences, the idea was to make kind of the same wine, maybe a small parcel in a very different way. So that's been tried many kind of different thing, temperature fermentation or time of fermentation. So the only way is to do that. But of course, all the mistakes in general has been reversed on the table wine or things like that, which was, I know, again, another waste of money in a way, but it's been important to try. And I have to say that there was a period in which there were some winemakers doing this kind of super Piemontese wine that mm-hmm. were wine that allow really to experiment a lot in this direction. But sure, we did some, maybe some mistakes were done. Too much oak, for example. Now we don't use so much oak anymore. We were using, there was a moment in where we were so fanatic. We were using 100% new oak every year. And that was really a waste of money because actually we realized then that the oak was kind of interfering with the wine. And that is maybe the most common mistake that we have made in those days.
And you might just have answered my next question, but maybe you could think of something else as well. So you said before that that some of the producers who we might call very traditional have learned from the people who are changing things up by maybe reducing yield and making a little bit more riper grapes and additional cleanliness, and even some very traditional producers who do single vineyard cru bottling. Have some of the more modern and forward-looking producers also kind of gone back towards the way of the traditionalists? That's something that I hear time and time again.
Yes.
That there's less of a divide between the most modern producers and the most traditional, that everyone's kind of coming towards the middle.
Absolutely. Yeah. Because of course the traditional wine were great wine. When you were talking before about some wine that were rustic, that were maybe a small farmer or whatever. So we, in our area, we always had a very, very good, very famous and great wineries, more classic in the vinification, but top quality wine, of course. And as I told you, yes, at the end, now I think that we are going back and we meet together in a certain in the middle, for example. So the concept of the cru, some people is going on, and even I do today, for example, I do only two cru that are so diverse, but I make a very classic Barolo, a more traditional, we can say, with the concept of the assemblage, so which is a great idea. So or the one, as I told you before, the mistakes that we have been doing using too much new wood. Today we solve it by reducing, of course, but also going back, for example, to the bigger barrel. That is very typical of the traditional heritage, so things are, when the new things comes, it looks always suspicious, but then they are kind of digested, and we take the good and throw the bad. And as again, but it's a thing that help each other, because again, on the other side, we take the good of the past and we try to improve what could be maybe something that, could have been improved.
And let's just go quickly through the different wines that you make. You make a Barbera.
Yeah, Dolcetto, Barbera, that are the most common fresh wine. They are all indigenous variety. And then from Nebbiolo, the Barolo, that is the highest denomination, and then a Nebbiolo Langhe, which is a second selection that, in my case, I use it for the younger vines and the younger grape.
And yeah, your total production is only a few thousand cases.
Yes, it's always very small. I remain very small. I only do 3,000 bottles. 3,000 cases, 35,000 bottles altogether. I have 8 hectares that are around 18 acres, but my brother, my younger brother Giorgio, joined me and helped me, so we are still a family family farm.
Mm-hmm. And the vineyards are all around your house, right? Very close?
Most. So I'm located in Barolo, mm-hmm. and so I have some vineyard in Barolo. But when my brother joined me, we purchased a new vineyard in Monforte d'Alba, which is a great villages of the denomination, in a location that is called Mosconi, and the wines are great in that area as well.
And for the future, is you're going to stay around this production level, or
yes.
is there?
I like small. I like artisanal, you know, and I like things that you can do, control your way. And I think that for the future, my interest is absolutely in working in the on the side of the vineyard better and better. So we are rethinking all the agriculture that's been done until today. I think that we're going toward a more clean and environmentally respectful. So I asked also the certification organic some years ago in 2010, and now what my idea is to be testimonial and to have more and more people join in this direction, and kind of having in the next future a complete biological district. In the areas.
Yeah. What do you think are some of the challenges to getting there? Are there are producers not wanting to do it because of thoughts that it's much more challenging or more
yes.
labor intensive?
Yes, it is, yeah. and more expensive. So it's really. There are some ideas, preconcept ideas, because of course, but it's true that it's a lot of work. And normally in our area, there are small wineries, and so that the family does themselves. And so the timing is very important, because you have to work on the prevention, you know. You don't have to wait that you have an infection, so you have to work very hard. That doesn't matter, you know, the timing is so crucial. And of course, you have an increase of cost very high, mm-hmm. because is even more intense the work, because you have to work much more.
Well, I have no doubt that you're going to continue, you know, one of the hardest working people in Barolo. So that's always that, you know, I don't know it firsthand, but the reputation, everyone says, you know, Cara's always working. She's always in the cellar. She's always in the vineyards, always making sure that everything is going well. And I'm sure that comes from the place of passion for what you're doing. Mm-hmm. I look up to you so much. I love what you do. You do such great work. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
And you can find the Ipiro wines at such notable restaurants as Dell'Anima, L'Artusi, and La Piccio. we carry them at all of our restaurants. As I said, I'm a big fan. So thanks to all of you so much for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.